Russian President Vladimir Putin visits his troops in occupied Ukraine.
A video released by the Kremlin shows Putin visiting the command post for Russian forces in the southern Kherson region and receiving reports from the top brass there.
Plus, an American journalist arrested in Russia for espionage must stay behind bars.
Evan's a journalist. He was out on assignment just doing his usual reporting work for the Wall Street Journal. His lawyers, he and his family, the US, all strongly deny that he is actually a spy. He's just a journalist.
And later in the program, the United States will assist Ukraine with the investigation and prosecution of the crime of Russian aggression. We'll hear from Kyiv. Today is Tuesday, April 18th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has visited the headquarters of the Russian troops fighting in Ukraine. From the Associated Press, Charles de Ledesma reports.
A video released by the Kremlin shows Putin visiting the command post for Russian forces in the southern Kherson region and receiving reports from the top brass there. He then moved by helicopter to the Russian National Guard in the Luhansk region to hear further information about the situation. Russia took the Kherson and Luhansk regions into its fold, along with Donetsk and Zaporizhia in September, in a move that was rejected by most of the world as illegal annexation. This is Putin's second trip to the areas that Russia occupies in Ukraine in as many months. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
VOA has not been able to independently verify the authenticity of the reporting, as the only video showing President Putin in occupied Ukrainian territory was furnished by the Kremlin. The relationship between Warsaw and Kyiv is stronger than ever. This despite a recent hiccup over grain exports. Taras Kuzio is a professor of political science at the National University of Kyiv Moyla Academy, and we discuss his new article for the Atlantic Council.
This is even more interesting from an American perspective, because you could say that the Central Intelligence Agency has a great success story, because the CIA funded a whole range of emigre groups from the late 40s, early 50s, through to through Gorbachev in 1990. And the two major Polish and Ukrainian groups, Instytut Literacki, Institute of Literature, which published a Kultura journal in Paris, and the Prologue Research Corporation, which published the Czasnys, the contemporary magazine in Munich, they were funded by the CIA, the U.S. government. So this covert support for democratic diaspora groups led to four decades of kind of reconciliation, coming together, overcoming the past. And this was extremely influential in the late 1980s with the Polish opposition movement, Polish Solidarity Group. The leaders of these Polish groups had been weaned on Kultura, that was the preeminent Polish emigre journal, and Kultura had been calling for 40 years for reconciliation with Ukrainians and Lithuanians, acceptance of the borders, and acceptance of the fact that Poland was a post-imperial country.
You also write that the alliance between Warsaw and Kyiv is strengthening. And Germany and France, for example, are struggling to come to terms with Russia's aggression. The political center of Europe is shifting to the east.
Well, it's not exactly east. The irony is that Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense under President Bush Jr., talked about old and new Europe. And he was kind of ridiculed a bit at the time, but he's actually proven to be historically correct. The West Europeans were quite arrogant and condescending towards the Balts and the Poles about, what do you know about Russia? You're all a bunch of Russophobes. We have to deal with Russia. We have to trade with Russia. But the invasion of Ukraine has shown that the German-French approach was totally wrong. And in fact, the Polish, Scandinavian, and Baltic approach was correct. That there is a Russian imperialist threat to its neighbors and to Europe in general. And the irony of all of this is that, well, firstly, Rumsfeld has been proven correct about olden Europe, but it's not necessarily geographically East and West Europe. It's more a state of mind. Because I would say that what you in fact have is an alliance between United Kingdom, Scandinavia, Poland, and the three Baltic states, who are all on the same page about this, and they're all pro-Ukrainian, and they openly talk about that Ukraine should defeat Russia. And then there are other countries, France, Germany, and even the Biden administration, which is afraid to talk about Russia being defeated. They say that Ukraine should be successful, but they don't actually want to take the extra step and say that we want Russia to be defeated. So, I mean, I think that it's not a geographical, it's more a state of mind. And so the Polish-Ukraine alliance is at the core of this. And certainly the geographic weight of NATO and Europe has moved, has shifted eastward.
And in the midst of all this, Poland has stopped importing grain and other agricultural products from Ukraine. How does this affect the relationship?
I think this is a product of the whole trade embargo that Russia has imposed on grain exports coming out of what's left of Ukraine's access to the Black Sea in Odessa and Mykolaiv. So I think it's because Russia is restricting trade in grains coming from there, that more grains are being exported through Central Eastern European countries, and that's obviously angering a lot of the domestic constituency in the agricultural sector.
You don't think it portends any problem for the relationship?
No. It's not a geopolitical question. This is more to do with economics and trade. And everybody understands, I mean, Ukraine's main trade has always been through the Black Sea, but that's proven more difficult. I don't think that there's simply no way that is going to change the view in Poland that this war is existentialist for Poland, and that Poland would be in dire straits and heavily threatened if Ukraine is defeated. So that support to Ukraine politically, diplomatically, I think economically, financially, and of course militarily is going to continue. Just look at the personal, very close relationships between President Duda and President Zelensky. I mean, they when they see each other, it's like two brothers re-meeting again.
Taras Kuzio is professor of political science at the National University of Kyiv Moela Academy. Professor, thanks for being with us. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you very much.
The United States will be assisting Kyiv in the investigation of certain war crimes. We get more from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
On Monday, United States Attorney General Mary Garland announced the appointment of a prosecutor to the International Center for the Prosecution of the Crime of Aggression against Ukraine, as well as the appointment of a legal advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv to provide aid to the Ukrainian government in terms of investigation and prosecution of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. And this is definitely a huge news and extremely important announcement, not only considering the fact that this would create huge, like, additional credibility to this body that was created, and that includes not only Ukraine itself, but also so the members of this team includes International Criminal Court and such countries as Lithuania, Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Slovakia, Romania, and now the representative of the U.S. And definitely this creates additional credibility to the body itself. to the prosecution and the investigation itself, but also additional credibility to the fact of these war crimes themselves, because we are hearing that Ukrainian authorities, they talk about these crimes all the time. They invite international community, international leaders to come to Ukraine and to see the scenes of these crimes with their own eyes, and international investigation teams are working at the recently liberated territories and in general across Ukraine. So, and this is one thing. And on the other side, Russian authorities, they deny these war crimes and that Russia actually conducted these war crimes.
We'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
While Sweden is still waiting for Turkey to approve its application to join NATO, they're hoping the upcoming Turkish elections, scheduled for May 14th, could be a turning point. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports.
Sweden and Finland lodged a joint application to join NATO just weeks after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The alliance welcomed Finland earlier this month, but Sweden's application has yet to be approved by NATO members Turkey and Hungary. Ankara has accused Sweden of harbouring groups it considers pro-Kurdish terrorists, which Sweden denies. Since the NATO application, Kurdish groups in Sweden have staged anti-Turkish demonstrations, protesting any deal with what they call a fascist government in Turkey. But Sweden's Prime Minister said he hoped next month's presidential elections in Turkey could mark a turning point. Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said, "Now we're waiting for the Turkish elections. I think everyone realizes that there is a substantial role in this, which is about Turkish domestic politics, and that is fully understandable. That's how it is in most countries." Sweden is set to introduce a new anti-terrorism law, which it hopes will persuade Turkey to approve its NATO application. Turkey has so far given a measured response. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Cavusoglu said earlier this month, "Of course, they have taken some steps, but they are not enough. We are expecting additional efforts in the coming period." NATO hopes that Sweden's application is ratified in time for the alliance's annual summit in July. Former Turkish diplomat Alper Koshkun is from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It will depend more on whether, in the aftermath of the elections, irrespective of who wins, the Turkish authorities will be able to say to themselves and to the public at large that some of Turkey's expectations from Sweden have been met in terms of the implementation of that very law.
Domestic issues trump foreign policy in Turkey's election campaign, and that could benefit Sweden's NATO application, says Koshkun.
Especially now, in the aftermath of the earthquakes and the economic circumstances in Turkey, it has even decreased even more. In that sense, I don't think, as far as the public opinion is concerned, or as far as the interest of the political parties in Turkey is concerned, it's a leading topic that there is attention on. And I think that alleviates the domestic political pressure on the issue, which should facilitate a solution post-election.
Turkish opposition parties have rallied behind a single candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, in an effort to unseat incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. An opposition win could benefit Sweden.
They've made it clear that they will underline Turkey's place within NATO, within the Western security architecture.
Meanwhile, Hungarian lawmakers say they are blocking Sweden's NATO bid over its recent criticism of their country's democratic credentials. Analysts say Turkey's approval of Sweden's bid would likely pressure Hungary to do the same. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. American Wall Street Journal journalist Evan Gershkovich's appeal has been denied by a Russian court. I speak with Jessica Jarid, VOA's press freedom editor, about the latest developments and about the state of press freedom in Russia.
Evan is the one of the Moscow correspondents for the Wall Street Journal. He's been living and working in Russia as a journalist since 2017 for the last year at the Wall Street Journal, and he covers everything from the war in Ukraine, the effect of economic sanctions that are being imposed by Western governments on Russia, just really looking at every sort of aspect of life in Russia at this moment in the way that any foreign correspondent would do in a big city.
And what happened to him? Why is it that we're talking about him today?
So Evan, since March 29th, has been in Russian custody. The Russians accuse him of espionage. He was on assignment in an eastern city in Russia, about sort of 800 miles from the capital, and was picked up by security. They're saying, without providing any evidence, they caught him red-handed, that he's a spy. Evan's a journalist. He was out on assignment just doing his usual reporting work for the Wall Street Journal. His lawyers, he and his family, the US, all strongly deny that he is actually a spy. He's just a journalist.
Do we know what story he was pursuing?
My understanding is that he was reporting on the sort of effects of the war and some of the ramping up of like military operations, and was in this eastern city, which has a lot of factories related to the military. But again, just reporting as anyone would be during at a time when the country that you cover is at war, just looking at the various aspects of that news story.
And what does this mean for other foreign journalists in Russia? It's got to be stifling.
There's a big security risk at the moment. When Russia first invaded Ukraine, they immediately started ramping up already very repressive policies that they have towards media. You couldn't call the war a war. It's like the biggest one. But like these hefty sentences for journalists and the people who provide information or even speak to journalists about what they can and can't say. At that time, some Western news organizations did pull their teams out for like concerns about what this could mean. But we've seen them go back in. Evan is one of those who's been in Moscow since that time. And really, a lot of analysts at the moment, people who study sort of Russian laws and policies, Russia's repressive policies towards media, really see Evan's case as sending a warning to other foreign media, to local journalists, even to people who might be thinking about talking to a foreign journalist, that there will be consequences. If Evan is convicted of espionage, he could spend 20 years in prison. And today he had a bail hearing, and they wanted to move him to house arrest while the case goes out. That's been denied. But Russia really are obstructing some of the normal due process that would happen in a trial. We only had, the US, I should say, only had consular access to him for the first time yesterday. This is the first time that he's been seen in public, really, was in one of those little glass cages in a Moscow courtroom today.
And what's the worldwide reaction been? We know that the United States has said he's unlawfully detained, but are other world leaders speaking out?
There has been, I think, any sort of Western democracy clearly sees this for what this is, as an attempt at leverage for Russia. They really don't have a lot of cards to play right now, and it's very valuable, high profile to nab an American journalist and put them on trial, accuse them of espionage. Generally, I think like the foreign media and Western governments, the EU, all see this as a journalist being detained just for doing their job, and are all calling for him to be released. He hasn't done anything wrong. He even had like the official media accreditation you have to have to work in Russia. He's out there doing his job, and it's just very convenient to accuse a journalist of being a spy. And it also sort of reinforces this sense to Russian audiences. I find it very interesting. We've had some interviews at VOA with people who study Russian propaganda and sort of analysts on Russian policy, who, even before Evan's case, had been looking at the laws in Russia that are being applied to media and critics, things like the foreign agent law that actually started way before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, where you use these sort of Soviet-era labels, accusing people of being a foreign agent, accusing them of being a spy. And it sends this subtle but very strong signal to a Russian audience that the West can't be trusted, that these people can't be trusted, that the information that is countering the Russian propaganda about why they're at war with Ukraine, why they're making these decisions, that Russia's narrative is the correct one and that these independent voices outside are the ones that can't be trusted. And I think that sort of sowing that seed of suspicion with any foreigner or Westerner helps them in their push to try to suppress information, to sort of create this sort of media blackout zone so they can just operate and do what they want.
Jessica Jarit is VOA's Press Freedom Editor. Ms. Jarit, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you.
In part one of this series, we met families who buried their loved ones in gardens because the cemetery was on the front lines of the war in Ukraine. Now in part two, VOA travels to Chasiv Yar, a city next to Bakhmut, the scene of the longest and bloodiest battle in the war. And experts say Chasiv Yar is now halfway surrounded by Russian forces. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
In the past week, at least three people have died in Chasiv Yar, Ukraine, and city workers say deaths and bombings are now regular occurrences. They say their main job now is to convince people who are still here to evacuate the city. This is Yevgeny Dmitriev, city administrator.
Many people have already left, and some humanitarian aid is still here. We want to move this humanitarian aid from here to a safer place.
Shelters here are called invincibility points, providing electricity to charge phones and internet access. About 20% of the population remains in Chasiv Yar, but most of the city services are not operating. On every block, homes and businesses are damaged or destroyed. Here's Alexander, a Chasiv Yar resident.
It was damaged. The windows were blown out. Yes, mostly the windows blown out. We cover them with plastic tarps. We cover them and life goes on.
Chasiv Yar is about 10 kilometers from the city of Bakhmut, where the longest and deadliest battle in Ukraine is currently taking place. Most observers, like journalists and aid workers, haven't been inside Bakhmut for more than a month. At that time, civilians were barely surviving on donated food and water in basements and shelters. As aid workers deliver food and water to the invincibility point in Chasiv Yar, they say this city looks eerily similar to what Bakhmut looked like a month or two ago. On the streets of Chasiv Yar, we meet Alexander Serkovich, who leads the aid organization, Peace and Kindness Fund.
This city is heavily damaged now. The last time we were here, it was in one piece, about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Ukraine says it plans to launch a massive counteroffensive this spring after winter battles that have killed many resulted in few advances for either side. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Chasiv Yar, Ukraine.
A top Ukrainian official says it's only a matter of time before his country's military achieves the necessary preparedness to launch its counteroffensive against Russian troops. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has that story.
The secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council tells the AP the country's allies are helping Ukraine acquire the necessary equipment to launch the attack, delivering heavy armored vehicles and ammunition. But Alexei Danilov also expressed frustration that allied officials sometimes promise one thing and do a completely different one. While he didn't elaborate, President Volodymyr Zelensky in his nightly address noted delays in the delivery of promised weapons cost the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. Danilov says Ukraine will not start any offensive unprepared, and while stopping short of confirming the Patriot air defense system promised by the U.S. has arrived, he says that Ukraine's current weapon stockpiles will be enough to curb Russia. I'm Ben Thomas.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media, be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba 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 zip. DC.